The following is an interview of Herbert Klossmeyer, Professor of Educational Psychology of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, conducted by Mark H. Van Pelt on May 22, 1979. It is part of the School of Education's Oral History Project, sponsored by Dean John R. Palmer.
I'm Professor Herbert Klossmeyer. I came to the University of Wisconsin in 1952. Prior to that, I'd been at the University of Northern Colorado for 3 years. I especially enjoyed the University of Northern Colorado. It was my first long-term college teaching experience after having received the doctorate in education from Stanford University in 1949. I was especially pleased to come to the University of Wisconsin and continue a teaching career. I have spent my entire life, except for 5 years in the Navy from 1941 to 1946, either as a teacher or as a student. And I have taught at all school levels, elementary, junior high, senior high, as well as at the university level, undergraduate through graduate courses.
Perhaps we can begin with a question about why was the Department of Educational Psychology formed?
The Department of Educational Psychology grew out of the Department of Education. The Department of Education had become a very large department after World War II, with the rapid increase in the number of students. As a Department of Education, the professor's staff were trying to serve the needs and interests of students interested in any aspect of education, whether it was educational administration, higher education, counseling and guidance, educational psychology, history, philosophy, sociology of education. The faculty then was quite diverse in terms of interests. It was large. We in educational psychology were able to communicate informally with one another, but there was relatively little opportunity for us to work together to develop particularly graduate programs that would attract graduate students. Along these lines also, the American Psychological Association had formed a separate Division of Educational Psychology in 1946. American psychological membership was limited to persons with PhDs in psychology. Our own graduate students were having difficulty being admitted to the American Psychological Association, and yet the American Psychological Association sort of served as a quasi-union for young beginning PhD candidates to get employment in departments of psychology or in programs of psychology. So by forming a Department of Educational Psychology, we were quite certain that this would assure that our own graduate students would be readily admitted to the American Psychological Association and also to the Division of Educational Psychology. And this is, in fact, what occurred. Once we were a Department of Educational Psychology, we were generally recognized then as preparing persons in the field of psychology. There were other good reasons also, because the large size of the Department of Education, the need to get educational psychology established as a visible scholarly area. One of these was a very practical matter. We were having difficulty arranging programs for our own graduate students which enabled them to specialize sufficiently in educational psychology. There were other departmental requirements they had to meet. And among those departmental requirements was a comprehensive examination. And that comprehensive examination, before we became a separate department, required them to take as much as 25 to 50% of their graduate studies, not in educational psychology, but in the minor or in some other area of the Department of Education. Mm-hmm. It did not permit sufficient specialization.
Now that we know some reasons why the department was formed, what sorts of things were included in this department, taking from the broad spectrum of choice that you had in the Department of Education?
Four main substantive areas were included, both at the graduate and undergraduate level. We continued the human learning area, the child development area, and the measurement and statistics area. At the start, the psychoeducational clinic continued as a clinic within the department, and there was certification of school psychometrists associated with that clinic. Over the years, the psychoeducational clinic area shifted to the present school psychology area, so that when we started, our major interest areas were human learning, human development, measurement and statistics, and the school psychometry, school psychology areas.
Now that we know a little bit about why the program was formed and what areas of study were included into it, could you talk a little bit about the various effects of the program? I guess we'll begin with the lowest level of the university at the undergraduate level.
At the outset, there was very little change made in our undergraduate offerings. We continued to offer a 3-credit required course in human learning and a 3-credit required course in child development or adolescent development. These courses were required of persons preparing to become teachers.
Was this either for elementary and or secondary people, or was it a distinction?
It was 6 credits for both elementary and secondary. The particular course they took in development varied: child development, elementary level, adolescent development, secondary level. The learning area was the same course for elementary and secondary. At the beginning, we made no change in that. As we hired more specialized professors, however, the professors in these specialized areas, as well as others who were more generalist, changed to a pattern of 1-credit courses. Each of us organized 2 or 3 1-credit courses directly related to our interests, such as creativity, personality, problem solving, affective learning, and so on. In turn, the students were permitted to elect from these many different 1-credit courses rather than to take the required 3-credit course. This change has been a very successful one. Whereas for years the required 3-credit ed psych courses were least popular among students, the 1-credit courses presently are among the most popular. And about 40% of all of the enrollment in the 1-credit courses at the present time are students from outside the School of Education who are interested in these psychological areas that we now offer. And I may add that the required courses in educational psychology in many colleges and universities are still very unpopular. Mm-hmm. Requiring all students with many different interests in subject matter interest in different levels of schooling to take the same course is still a fairly unpopular arrangement.
One of the things that it seems to me has also happened in this period since the formation of the department is that there has been a change in the number of credits required for certification in educational psychology. Is that correct?
Yes. Okay. The number has fluctuated. I think at the present time it is probably six still for elementary teaching candidates. It's probably no more than 2 to 4 for secondary mm-hmm. candidates.
In the old situation, though unpopular, students received a coherent picture of educational psychology, at least hopefully. In the new situation with the modules, is it possible for students to get somewhat of a disjointed picture? Is that been felt as a problem by the faculty?
I think it's recognized as a possibility. I am not certain, however, that the required 3-credit courses really gave a coherent picture of a specialized field.
Uh-huh.
The present 1-credit courses probably reflect the area of educational psychology fairly well. It is not a tightly organized discipline
mm-hmm.
such as one would find for American history or chemistry or comparative literature.
Mm-hmm.
And it probably won't be. It is still an emerging area.
Okay. Moving up to the next higher level within the university, I suppose, in the hierarchy, concerning effects would be to speak to the development of the graduate program.
The graduate program is what has emerged from a very weak program in the old Department of Education to a very strong program. The Department of Educational Psychology today is recognized as an outstanding program for the preparation of PhD candidates. And for many years, we focused only on preparation of the PhD person. We did not encourage persons who wanted only a master's degree to come into our department.
Mm-hmm.
We tried to recruit persons who would come upon completing a baccalaureate degree and then stay through completion of the PhD program. As a result of this, we were able to attract very able students and have produced a very capable group of students in the experimental design field, statistics, human learning, human development, and increasingly now in the area of school psychology. Part of this came about because we also changed our recruitment policies for faculty. Whereas when I came here, very few faculty were recruited who did not have teaching experience at the elementary or secondary school level. When we became a Department of Ed Psych, we deliberately sought faculty who were specialized in one or another field of psychology, such as learning or child development
mm-hmm.
or adolescent development.
Since the time that you've been separated as a distinct department and pursued this policy, have you found it a problem just in establishing lines of communication that is not necessarily having a common ground of experience with some people in the other areas of education?
This is a continuing problem. The whole matter of the extent to which there should be increased specialization at the expense of a more broad general education continues. We don't know how much work a person within the department should take in learning in relation to human development, measurement, school psychology. Similarly, it is not clear as to how much of a background in either education or psychology more generally the person should have. The decision then rests almost exclusively with the individual student and the professor as to how highly specialized or as to how general the person prepares.
Mm-hmm. Now, as I understand in talking with you earlier, the number of students who are coming to the program since the Organization of Educational Psychology as a department are more frequently from disciplines such as psychology, with undergraduate majors in psychology, than they have been in the past. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. Whereas earlier, the large number of our PhD candidates were persons who had prepared initially as teachers or who had a high interest in education. Increasingly, students come whose background as undergraduates has been psychology, sociology, other behavioral sciences. Occasionally, we have persons with a major at the undergraduate level in one of the biological sciences. Occasionally, there are students with backgrounds in mathematics. Mm-hmm. Students who have not prepared for teaching, but who have an interest in education.
Mm-hmm. Are there still a large number of students from education who major in as graduates in educational psychology?
The majority still are persons who have, as undergraduates, met the requirements for a teaching certificate.
Mm-hmm. There's a further aspect of the specialization problem, which I've noticed that in your department discourages the development of an external minor in other areas of education outside of ed psychology and prefers them to go into psychology or statistics or other related fields.
Some professors and students feel that in terms of the student's area of interest, the minor can be served better in psychology, sociology, if the person is in human development or human learning,
mm-hmm.
and in mathematical statistics, computer science, if the person is in the quantitative area.
Mm-hmm.
This is a preference of the individual professor. Among my advisees, there are probably as many take a minor in the department, one of the departments of education, as in the department of psychology, sociology, one of the behavioral sciences.
Do you think that it would be possible for you to make some sort of generalization about the association of the person's undergraduate major with the external minor that they tend to choose? That is, do people who are undergraduate majors with a certification in education, the ones who tend to take external minors in education, or are they the ones who tend to take the academic minors?
I think that it's less dependent upon what they have taken as undergraduates and more dependent of what their career goals are upon completion of the PhD. If, regardless of what their undergraduate majors are, if they desire to go into a department of psychology, it's well for them to take a minor in our department of psychology.
Okay. Moving probably to the what might be regarded as the next level of effects is if you could comment a little bit about the effects of the reorganization on the teaching and training or the teaching and research activities of the faculty.
The largest change came about in the research activities of the faculty. And that change is related not only to a shift to the Department of Educational Psychology, but also federal policies regarding support of educational research. In 1954, the Cooperative Education Research Act was passed. Dean Stiles brought researchers from this School of Education and program officers from Washington together. And in 1956, a substantial number of us were first funded with federal funds to carry out our research. Personally, I had one of the first grants received from a federal agency, and from 1956 up to the present time, I have continuous funding from one or another federal agency for the research activities which I'm involved with, and I think many other professors are also, not in the Department of, only in the Department of Ed Psych, but also other professors. As we had external funds and also continuing funds from the graduate school to carry out our research activities, we tended to do somewhat less teaching and to focus somewhat more on our research activities. I hope that most of us have kept a pretty good balance between the two. And I am confident that our research activities have permitted us to offer much better graduate courses. Our research activities have kept us at the forefront of knowledge and methodology in our areas of specialization. We have been able to communicate this to and with our graduate students. Mm-hmm. So I think it has proven to be effective in developing better graduate programs for our own graduate students and being at the forefront of knowledge. If we were to examine the one credit teacher certification courses that we offer and our research funded efforts, we'd find a close relationship between the two of them. Mm-hmm. We are doing our research in many of the same areas in which we do both our graduate and undergraduate teaching. By having a community of scholars, most of whom are funded to carry out research, we have been able to establish excellent programs. Our own graduate students, former graduate students, are now in important national and international leadership positions in educational research as well as educational psychology. Similarly, our own faculty has served in many offices, elected offices. Four of us have served as president of the Division of Educational Psychology. Three have served as presidents of the American Educational Research Association. These are the two most important national organizations in educational research. The kinds of activities in which we're involved in other national, international activities are of a similar kind. Many of us have served as editors or advisor editors of the major journals. We have served on quite a number of commissions, councils of one sort or another. The effect of this kind of serving the larger national and international community, as well as our own graduate students, has permitted us to recruit faculty of high caliber one year after another, also very able graduate students. Many of our own PhD students have started their program of publications, including article writing, as graduate students. It's not uncommon for our PhD candidates to have already published 3, 5 or so journal articles by the time they have completed the degree.
This raises to my mind a few questions. Of course, in the first years when you were here in the middle 1950s, before the reorganization, the number of people involved in the educational psychology field within the department wasn't nearly as great as it is now. And would my perception that senior faculty fairly regularly taught the undergraduate courses be accurate?
Yes. When I came here, the teaching load was 9 credits. We had absolutely no external support for our research. Occasionally, we got a little graduate school research support. So our main role was teaching, counseling with students, and our research was limited to what our graduate students did.
Mm-hmm.
There was very little research that the faculty person himself was involved in.
Were you restricted also to how much time you had free to teach graduate level courses as compared to in recent years?
That has not changed a great deal. We did, with few exceptions, teach undergraduate teacher certification courses in the Department of Education. At the present time in our department, of some 17 faculty members, there are only 3 who do not teach at least 1 teacher certification course a year.
Mm-hmm.
While we as a department don't require that now, most of the faculty enjoy, particularly the 1 credit teacher certification course. It's a very enjoyable teaching situation, and without any requirement, we do not insist on this at all. When we hire a new person, we find that the large majority of our new faculty, as well as the faculty who have been here for a while, are teaching teacher certification courses.
Mm-hmm. On the whole, though, your teaching load has decreased compared to the middle 1950s.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
The amount of graduate teaching load has stayed about the same. And the amount of undergraduate load then has decreased, although most faculty still do it.
No, I think that at the present time, our undergraduate teaching in relation to graduate teaching is more than it was. It's at least as much. This is probably due to the fact not only of the interest of the faculty, but also in the past 3 to 5 years, the decreasing enrollment at the graduate school level.
Mm-hmm.
Our applications for PhD type graduate students has decreased substantially in the past 5 years. And among other things, I have personally taken the initiative to organize a terminal master's degree program for teachers, started this last year. It is turning out to be a very successful program. We have great interest in teachers in the immediate environment of this university, interested in the program, who are now enrolling in the program. And I suspect that as teacher education enrollments continue to fall off, the number of graduate students interested at the PhD in a level in educational psychology will continue to decrease. It won't decrease as rapidly as it has in some other fields, such as history or philosophy, perhaps, but I think it's going to decrease for a while. And our enrollments have been very large in the undergraduate field for the past 5 years.
In other words, what you're saying too is that when you reorganize the department, part of the basis of the reorganization was to try to attract high caliber students who would be interested mainly in getting a doctoral degree.
In our department, yes. Mm-hmm. For years, we recruited persons who had recently completed a baccalaureate degree, young persons, mm-hmm. 21, 25 years of age, who in turn would complete a PhD mm-hmm. in 3 to 5 years. And many of our PhD candidates are under 30 years of age, mm-hmm. whereas before, the large majority of them were 35 or older. Mm-hmm.
And you seem to be indicating now that because of changing composition of enrollments that you're once again bringing a little bit stronger emphasis to people who are coming in from as teachers who are interested in master's degrees and having to reorient your department a little bit that way.
That is true. 3 years ago I presented an invited address at the American Psychological Association meeting in which I was invited to give my impressions of the future of educational psychology. It is perfectly clear that many young, able persons recognize that employment opportunities are relatively meager for educational psychologists in teacher education institutions. Mm-hmm. And that is where the majority of our candidates have been employed. Mm-hmm. Recognizing this, these young people are simply not coming into departments of educational psychology to prepare for this kind of work. And I would agree with them that we don't need large numbers. In addition to this, over the past 15 years, a large number of universities that did not have PhD programs did also develop PhD programs. So the supply of PhDs in educational psychology has increased very greatly in this period of years from 1960 to 1975. And the demand is dropping off still.
One last aspect of these various changes in certification and in teaching loads and so on and so forth is that with variation, since the department has come into existence, there seems to have been greater use of teaching assistants, principally those doctoral students who you worked hard to attract to teach the one credit courses for certification. Is that accurate?
This is a matter of individual preferences of professors. I think the majority of professors, such as myself, attend every class. We make every major presentation. The teaching assistant is an assistant. Mm-hmm. Helps with such matters as developing the syllabus, developing evaluative instruments, procedures, occasionally presents information about the student's area of interest, and then also counsels with individual students from the class and works with small groups of students. Mm-hmm. A few professors invite their teaching assistant as a kind of professional preparation to do a substantial amount mm-hmm. of the large group presentation. That's the minority of persons, mm-hmm. however, in our department. We do try to follow the policy of a teaching assistant not having group larger than 19 for instruction. Mm-hmm.
You were mentioning the other day, though, that sometimes in the past that has not always been the case, that there's been a problem with the loads of students not being in tune with the contract stipulations of the TAA?
At times, there is a tendency, I think, for lack of communication. Perhaps the TA doesn't see what the TA is doing as something related to the professional preparation. Mm-hmm. And this has been a problem in some instances.
Does the problem of class size originate, well, of course,
The TA contract says that the TA will not teach classes larger than, what is it, 16, 19, something of that sort.
19.
Right.
But the point being that if you have large enrollments, popular courses, that in part there's a problem of funding. Is this a problem of just lack of funding for the school education for TAs? Where does that side of it originate in your?
I am relatively unaware of these matters. Mm-hmm. As you may know, I am funded heavily by research. Mm-hmm. From 50 to 75% of my salary every semester is paid from research funds. Mm-hmm. I don't do a great deal of teaching. I do each year teach at least one graduate course and at least one undergraduate course. Mm-hmm. I attend every class unless I have to be off campus. I assume responsibility for developing the course outline and for making the formal presentations. The TA in my sections does not offer whole class lectures unless the TA wishes to do so to get some experience in lecturing to a large group. Mm-hmm. And where these various difficulties arise in the department, I'm uncertain.
Okay. Once the department was formed, you were, of course, increasingly putting emphasis on research. You were encouraged to do this by Dean Stiles. As a result of these things and others, there was a formation of a research and development center here on campus of great size and importance. Perhaps you can talk a little bit about how that came about.
I'd be delighted to. As I have indicated earlier, Dean Stiles brought together program people from Washington and researchers here on the faculty of the School of Education. And a few of us were the very first persons who received federal funds to support our research in 1956. We have had continuing support thereafter. The initial funding for research, only $1 million a year back in 1956, had to be done on mental retardation. My research project, the first one, was a study of learning and retention in mentally retarded children in comparison with children of average and high abilities. From 1956 up to about 1962, the amount of monies for research by the federal government increased, but also there was a recognition that having many different persons carrying out small research projects may not have led to solution of educational problems and the improvement of education. So under the Kennedy administration, as part of the New Frontier Program, the Research and Development Center Program was formulated as federal policy. The Research and Development Center Program of the Office of Education was established to enable research and development centers to be started on university campuses. The purpose of those centers was not only to carry out basic and applied research in a particular problem area, but also to disseminate knowledge from that research and also to put it into a form that schools could use. So the research development centers established on university campuses were to engage in the entire process from basic research to school improvement. Again, Dean Stiles was instrumental in getting that kind of program established in the federal government. So he proposed, apparently to a number of persons, that they might be interested in writing a research proposal for establishing an R&D center on this campus. Two of us did. I led one group of persons in developing a proposal to establish an R&D center dealing with cognitive learning, giving particular attention to improvement of education in areas such as reading, mathematics, writing. Another group developed a proposal for re-education. It appeared to the program officers in Washington not to be in the best interests to have two centers on one campus, and also in terms of their priorities, they were somewhat more interested in the cognitive learning area than they were in the re-education area. So our center was started in 1964 as the Wisconsin Research and Development Center for Cognitive Learning. Dean Stiles served as the co-director for administration. I served as the co-director for research. Dean Stiles was most helpful in getting the relationships established with Washington, with the Department of Public Instruction here in the state, with university officials right from the outset. I was responsible pretty largely for determining the areas of research and development in which we would engage and taking care of getting the research development efforts started. After two or three years, Dean Stiles apparently thought that the center was in reasonably good hands, so I became director of the center. The projects on re-education that started initially as part of the center were completed within 2 to 4 years, and we did then become a center for cognitive learning. This narrowing of interests was part of the effort of the federal government. The research and development centers on university campuses were part of the Kennedy administration. We all recall that President Johnson, a former school teacher, wanted things done immediately. And in the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which was passed in 1965, provisions were made for the establishment of regional educational laboratories. There was to be a regional educational laboratory serving a group of states, and those regional educational laboratories were to be the school improvement efforts. They were to take the knowledge from research, put it into forms that schools could use, and improve schooling. With the funding of the regional educational laboratories, there was a cessation of starting new R&D centers on university campuses. Only 10 got started. Then the regional labs started. With the establishment of 20 regional labs, 10 centers, it became necessary for each center and lab to have a focus for its work. At our center, we decided to focus at the elementary school level. We simply, while we had good funding, starting at $500,000 in 1964, going to about $1,200,000 within 2 years, we stayed at that $1,200,000 level for a few years. About 1970 or 71, we went up to close to $2 million. But while the laboratories were being started, we were on flat funds. And to make a reasonable contribution to the improvement of education, we decided that we would focus at the elementary school level and primarily in the areas of reading, mathematics. And that is what our R&D center spend most of its efforts at in the early years. But in order to improve education of boys and girls in these skills areas, we thought also that it was necessary to change from the traditional age-graded school to another form of schooling. I coined the term individually guided education to represent the kind of changes that were needed in the elementary schools. I worked closely with Russ Way of the Department of Public Instruction. We had an advisory committee that included people from the Department of Public Instruction, local schools, myself and others from the R&D Center that met each month. The IGE concept got started from 1966 to 1968. In 1968, the Department of Public Instruction took the role in this state for disseminating information about IGE and actually helping elementary schools change from their traditional forms of schooling to the IGE pattern. As a result, today about 25-30% of all of the elementary schools in this state are IGE. Mm-hmm. With this sort of success story in Wisconsin, then, the Office of Education in 1971 funded the R&D Center at about $1 million a year for 3 years to take elementary IGE nationwide. And I worked with our faculty here in the R&D Center in identifying chief state school officers who were interested, and we worked out arrangements whereby in each of those states, someone in the Department of Education of that state served as a kind of liaison person to bring IGE concepts and practices to the elementary schools of that state. We never were funded to develop teacher education materials, and one of the big problems in any school improvement effort is that the teacher education institutions should not only make prospective teachers and principals aware of new innovations, they should also be working with schools, the current school staffs, in improving their practices. One of the reasons the teacher education institutions couldn't do this about IGE was that they did not have the kind of materials they needed in their own teacher education courses. The program officer of the Sears Roebuck Foundation had already shown much interest in teacher education, and in 1972 had already funded several teacher education planning projects. He heard about IGE, came to Wisconsin, talked with us, invited a proposal. I set up a number of committees and prepared a proposal at the invitation of the Sears Roebuck Foundation, to fund the IGE Teacher Education Project. And from 1972 to 1977, we developed 9 sets of materials, a textbook, a film, 2 or 3 film strips, instructional guides in each of 9 areas, 1 for administration, 1 for teachers, 1 for unit leaders, others for teaching math, teaching science, social studies, and so on. Each of these sets of materials could be used in either of 2 ways: by the professor in a teacher education institution in his graduate or undergraduate classes, and also by that professor working with local schools. Mm-hmm. These teacher education materials then were developed over these years and are being used quite widely in quite a large number of teacher education institutions of the United States. The most widespread and effective use is going on in the state universities right here in the state of Wisconsin. Eau Claire, La Crosse, Stevens Point in particular. Those 3 institutions have excellent programs related to IGE.
Well, this raises a number of questions for me. First of all, just sort of a clarification question. You mentioned that approximately now 25 to 30% of the elementary schools in Wisconsin are IGE. Mm-hmm. Now, as I understand IGE, you can sort of take a whole package or you can take parts of the package. When you mean 25 to 30%, do you mean that have at least some part of their program in IGE?
Right. IGE is not a static form of schooling. IGE is an approach to educational improvement, renewal, that is continuously changing. When I say that 25-30% are IGE schools, that many have usually the organizational aspect, that is, the teachers are organized into teams rather than continuing to teach in age-graded separate classrooms. Mm-hmm. Nearly all of them have that. Mm-hmm. Nearly all of them also arrange their instruction differently in at least 1 or 2 curricular areas from the usual pattern, and those curricular areas are usually mathematics, reading, or spelling. They offer more small group instruction in those areas to boys and girls who are at the same level of skill development, regardless of age, instead of proceeding in the usual way of each teacher trying to teach a classroom group of 25 to 30.
Mm-hmm. The mention of team teaching reminds me that there at least could be a sort of an integral relationship between this program or certain aspects of it and the Wisconsin Improvement Program.
Yes, this is interesting. John Guy Fowlkes was the dean of the School of Education when I came from the University of Northern Colorado to the University of Wisconsin in 1952. And part of the reason that I came was because my doctoral dissertation, which had been published in 2 or 3 articles, was known to the people here in educational psychology. My doctoral dissertation reported how I, working as a teaching assistant, had developed a functional course in educational psychology while a graduate student at Stanford University. This sort of interest in the sort of work that I was doing was indicated personally to John Guy Fowlkes, then dean, by my first advisor at Stanford, who happened to be Professor Edward Krug. When I first went to Stanford, Ed Krug was on the faculty there. The next year, he came back here to Wisconsin. So these personal interests were involved, and John Guy Fowlkes, among the persons I know, had as keen a commitment to the improvement of education as anyone I have ever met. When he resigned as dean, he first went to India for a couple of years. Then he came back and started the Wisconsin Improvement Program with funding from the Ford Foundation. I had indicated earlier that I had research support from the federal government. I also received research support from the Wisconsin Improvement Program, the Ford Foundation money that John Guy Fawkes was responsible for. And some of the early work that two or three of the people, graduate students, did with me was research on team teaching as part of the Wisconsin Improvement Program. Mm-hmm. So you can be assured that when IGE started, it started in some of the same school districts where the Wisconsin Improvement Program was already functioning and where already in the schools part of the teachers were either already in teams or they were familiar with the concepts. The administrators were also. So the background for moving toward the team teaching concept in IGE was quite fully established throughout this state of Wisconsin already through the Wisconsin Improvement Program.
There are a number of different things that the R&D Center must have had influence on. For instance, one thing that it introduced to the School of Education, which I don't believe had existed to a great extent before, was the introduction of a fairly large number of people who were non-teaching staff. Is that accurate?
Yes, this is true. When one does research in schools, one cannot do that research at the convenience of graduate students' schedules. One must do the research when it's possible to do it in the schools. This requires that most larger projects have at least one full-time person who coordinates, monitors the research in the schools. In addition, when one is developing a curriculum, such as mathematics or reading, this too requires full-time persons who can concentrate solely for 2 to 5 years on the development of those materials, where that's their number one priority, not completing graduate school requirements. As an organization gets fairly large with a budget of $2 to $3 million a year, there are accounting and budgeting requirements. In this R&D center, we must meet the requirements imposed by the university, by the state of Wisconsin, as well as the federal government. So there needs to be full-time staff to work on the business, budgeting, accounting aspects of the whole operation. When we were at the height of developing curriculum materials, we had more full-time academic employees than we had either graduates, not graduate students, we always had more graduate students, a few, but we had more full-time employed people, academic appointments, than we had professors for a while. Mm-hmm.
Were these people recruited from all around the country, or were many of them recent graduates of the university who applied their specialties to the areas of interest?
A large number of them were graduate students of the University of Wisconsin, either with master or PhD degrees. That was one large group. A second large group were persons, including many females, who either were married, living here in Madison, or who came to Madison because it was a desirable place to live. For quite a number of the specific tasks, we did conduct national searches and brought in persons from all over the nation for particular specialized positions. As the center changed over the years, first we were mostly research projects, then we were heavily involved in development. Once we got into dissemination and needed teams of persons to work with people in state education agencies and local school districts throughout the nation. Increasingly, we employed more persons, academic positions, who were neither graduate students nor professors. In recent years, the center is moving back more toward the research. Under the National Institute for Education, which came into being in 1972, the center is no longer being funded to help schools change. It is no longer being funded to develop curricular materials. And exactly what it will be funded to do in the future is problematic at this point, right at this point in history. The staff, administrative staff of the center is considering with NAIE officials future directions for the center.
Mm-hmm. Has the center served as a vehicle for some people to gain positions on the faculty? That is, has there been any people who pursue the route of coming in as specialists here and then coming onto the faculty afterwards?
This has not occurred in a single case, to the best of my knowledge. There has not been a single person who has come to the center as a full-time academic employee who has subsequently been employed on the faculty of any instructional department.
I would kind of like to ask you a little bit about some of the different aspects of impact of all of the work of the R&D Center on certain areas. For instance, on the School of Education in general, what do you feel has been the impact of the R&D Center? That is, has it changed the direction of research as the school have been, from what the school have been moving into, how has it affected things of that sort?
The principal way the R&D Center has affected the School of Education is that it has made available large sums of research monies over substantial periods of time for 25 to 50 professors and this in turn has enabled those professors to proceed right to the cutting edge, the very forefront of knowledge in their fields. Many professors who have been in the center anywhere from 3 up to 8 or 10 years have during that period of time moved to the forefront in their areas of specialization. Mm-hmm. I would say that is probably the number one contribution of this R&D Center. And when we see national ratings that place the School of Education among the top 5 in the United States, some portion of that rating is related to professors receiving consistent, substantial support for anywhere from as short as 3 years up to 10 or 15 years to support their rather large-scale research efforts to recruit very able graduate students. In other words, to establish a team of researchers who have really made significant contributions to extending knowledge in their areas, number one. The second is that the professors who have participated in center activities also have used their research knowledge, brought it into their teaching. I would say that that is the second way that it has occurred. In addition, for the persons who've not been affiliated with the center, it has contributed to their awareness that for a school of education to be great, there must be this kind of research effort carried out, not by all of the faculty, but a portion of the faculty. Mm-hmm.
Related to this, what departments would you say have been most heavily involved with work in the R&D Center?
Oh, this is clear. Early years, it was from the School of Education, Department of Educational Psychology, Curriculum and Instruction. One or two persons from a few other departments of the School of Education. In the last 10 years, it has been Curriculum and Instruction, Educational Administration, Educational Psychology. Always there have been 3 to 5 professors from other departments outside of the School of Education. This partly is related to what I discussed earlier, the focus of the R&D Center. Every center had to have a focus. Ours was cognitive learning. Since it was cognitive learning, this meant that we did not involve professors in physical education, art, music, these areas. Our fundings were to go to the particular area of the cognitive domain rather than other domains. And it was not until we got into IGE with its changed organization for instruction and changed administrative pattern that people in educational administration became part of the center.
There is a natural tendency with an organization that consists of several relatively autonomous departments for them to tend to stay one to themselves, one to another. Do you think that because of both the size of the R&D Center and because of the nature of it being of a particular aspect of educational research, that has further increased a tendency for, or at least a perception on the parts of some people, to be isolated from other areas of the school of education?
I suspect that the matter is not so much of isolation, but of different patterns of activities. A pattern of activity of more teaching and counseling and service if you're outside the center. One more of research activities, less teaching and counseling if you're within the center. And then along with this, in a university like this, there is higher payoff for the visible scholarly production associated with having consistent research funds. Mm-hmm. And it is perfectly clear over the years that if the center administration does a good job of recruiting productive scholars, good researchers, initially, then those people get funded one year after another. A tremendous advantage is going to accrue to those persons in terms of promotion, a scholarly advancement, and I think this has occurred. And this has tended then also to sort of establish an in-group and a kind of an out-group. I think this is true not only in the School of Education, I think it's true of every center on this big campus. Mm-hmm. We have many, many centers, and so nearly as I know, it's true in the other centers too. In this regard, I would say that even though the Research and Development Center's program started in the federal government in 1964, It's still only 15 years of age. It has to be regarded as experimental. Mm-hmm. The future of R&D centers on university campuses is very unclear. Mm-hmm. It will, I believe, remain unclear for quite a number of years. The future is not one of continuity, tradition, the way instructional departments are. The likelihood that our instructional departments will continue for the next 25, 50 years, oh, there may be some reorganization in the School of Education, but the likelihood that we're going to continue as strong departments is very probable. There is no tradition. There is no large group of R&D centers. There are only about 6 to 8 left. What's going to happen to R&D centers is going to depend pretty largely, I think, on the kind of initiatives, leadership, right on the university campus.
Mm-hmm. Not only, as you point out, well, the effects on groups of people on campus and their development, do you think that the R&D Center has had an effect on what different groups of people view as acceptable types of research, particularly as, for instance, do you believe that it has in some way enhanced the credibility of certain styles of research over other styles of research? That is, for instance, you know what I mean, I think.
Yes. If one has funds from the graduate school to carry out research, it's necessarily short-term. Mm-hmm. If one gets research from almost any federal agency, it is necessarily short-term, except there is a tendency now, if one gets started in a particular line of research, to get it supported for many years. But I think it is recognized nationally that for research in any field, whether it's medicine, environment, space, whatever, and we have those centers on this campus, to make much of an impact, there must be a substantial commitment of financial resources and human resources directed towards a pretty focused area. Mm-hmm. The separate research projects, short period research project, do contribute somewhat to advancing knowledge, but they don't contribute a great deal to solving problems or to reach goals. Mm-hmm. The only way we get a man on the moon is to make a concerted effort to do it. The only way we make some advance in finding the cures and causes of cancer is to set up centers for that. The way we're dealing with mental retardation is not to fund 10,000 graduate students for 6 months to 2 years, mm-hmm. but to set up centers for research on mental retardation. To what extent our own faculty recognizes that this sort of approach is likely to continue, I don't know. I think the majority of them do. Mm-hmm. I think the majority recognize that while one can extend knowledge through working with graduate students, each doing his or her own dissertation of interest, the cumulative effects often are not very great from that kind of approach. Mm-hmm. And if we do have problems to solve, such as career education, it does take a large, concerted effort of the kind that only the federal government appears to be able to support.
Mm-hmm. But, okay. The other aspect of the question that I had was, does it tend to cause some people to view other types of research, that is, for instance, parts of the School of Education are involved in historical research, which historical research being somewhat different ballgame. Has this tended to cause people to see these different styles of research as being of lesser importance than they had in the past?
I suspect it does. Mm-hmm. I'm not so sure that The primary reason for this is other than that. Researchers necessarily do research where the money is. One can get funded today for research in career education, equity, minority education, bilingual education, basic skills. Mm-hmm. That is where the federal monies are going. The federal monies are not going for philosophical research, historical research. They're not going for many surveys. And I don't believe that it's so much anything deliberate or thought of by people here. I think it's more a reaction to sources of funding and the areas in which one must do research if one is going to secure funds.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a... The reaction to that would be, a superficial reaction would be that you're saying that the academician, the professor, in these days is not the one who's determining firsthand the direction of research.
Oh, yes, I am saying that directly. The professor for years has not been the primary determinant of the substantive area of research or even the methodology. The fund-granting agency, which is the federal government, unfortunately, is becoming more directive every year. In my lifetime with federal support from 1956, the increasing amount of directiveness of the federal government is a very severe and acute problem. This is why I said earlier that the future of research and development centers in education on university campuses, in my judgment, is not yet determined. It is possible that the federal government will exercise so much directiveness that it simply is not appropriate for professors at a university to attempt to carry out all of the directions they give up. Once they give up too much of their freedom of action, there's no payoff for it.
Some people I've talked to have indicated much the same comment with the proviso that they felt that in the early years of federal funding that faculty were given considerable voice in the shaping of these initial proposals, that is, that the funding was of a little bit more general nature, not so specifically drawn, and that their freedom was fairly well preserved. And since then, something has happened.
We had much freedom in determining what we would focus on. We had to have a focus. We could not just have a group of separate projects in the center. But we determined what that focus and substantive area would be. Mm-hmm. And that is no longer possible. The mechanism that the federal government employs to enforce this is they change from giving grants to contracts. That came in the early 1970s. With contracts, what the federal government does, program officials decide what it is they want research on. They write a request for proposals. This is a published paper which says, we want this research done in this area on this topic. Different persons and agencies then bid to do that research. And based on a competitive criteria, one or another person or agency is awarded a contract to carry out that research. What the federal government has done is contracting to procure research accomplished the same way they would contract through competitive bidding to get services performed or to buy equipment such as pencils, automobiles, tanks, airplanes. Mm-hmm. And the federal government is not only moving in that direction to control the substance and methods of research, they're also proceeding in the same way to control monies that are going to the states for education purposes, whether it goes to the state education agency or to local school districts. They're not making those grants except with so many guidelines to be followed that it greatly restricts the recipient of the money.
Mm-hmm. In the good old days, so to speak, as you mentioned, Dean Stiles, for instance, sort of had the ear of some of these people in Washington in the days before contracting. Now, I can see where it's possible that you can have a contract system, and yet the university could sort of keep the ear of the people involved in writing contracts to the extent that, though it was a contract system, the contracts coming out were in large part shaped by the university. This does not appear to be happening, however.
It has not happened in recent years as it relates to this campus. Whether it is happening as related to other campuses where there are R&D centers, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I am sure, however, that it is happening between the regional educational laboratories and federal agencies.
Mm-hmm.
One of the regional educational laboratories, I read in its most recent annual report, has established an office in Washington, D.C., and has put a full-time person in an office in Washington for this purpose.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to this, way back about 1970, we center and lab directors met together, we formed an association, and we set up an agency, a full-time person, a secretary, and that person also has an office in Washington. The person is an information person. The person, and now it's a pretty large staff, but the main role is to provide information to congressmen, senators, and staff persons.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that education is not political, or that educational research funding is not political, is naivete. It is, and it will continue to be.
I have one last question. You've talked quite a bit about what reorganization did to the nature of the Department of Educational Psychology. Perhaps you could temper some of those comments with respect to how the R&D Center affected the department and its development.
I think the R&D Center effects have been generally desirable, although they're probably mixed. Quite a number of appointees in our department, faculty, from 1970 on, have been aware of the R&D Center, and many of them in their first year have had funding from the R&D Center. So it has helped us in recruiting a considerable number of our present faculty, including our most productive scholars. At the same time, there has been this continuing tension, which I think is healthy, that persons in our department who do have that kind of funding have somewhat of an advantage over those who do not. And that was somewhat more acute 5-10 years ago than it is today, because most persons in the department, whether in the center or not, do have support for their research activities. I think that with 4 to 8 faculty members every year receiving some research support from the R&D Center, it has served as a fairly stable source of research for those people in our department, and I think that the results on the department as a whole are beneficial, highly beneficial.
Okay, we've been concentrating heavily on the academic side of what the R&D Center has meant and how it got started and the purposes and therefore, but there are other aspects to that problem of development.
There are always many, and there are always negative as well as positive, but one of the positive, this school of education, when I came here, was in a building that the Department of Engineering had moved out of. For years, we had no buildings. When the R&D Center was started, we first were in a basement office of the School of Education. Then we were in an abandoned Kroger grocery store on University Avenue. Our next move was to rent the second floor of the Regent Apartments on Regent Street. As part of that 1965 Elementary Secondary Education Act, authorization was made to provide monies to build regional educational laboratory facilities and R&D centers. Subsequently, the money was appropriated. From about 1968 until this building opened in 1972, Dan Wolpert and myself must have spent at least the equivalent of 1 to 2 months of the year working with federal, state, and local officials to get monies to build the present building called Educational Science Unit 1. This building was opened in the fall of 1972. We moved in. Dedication was in a snowstorm in April following. The total funds for this building, including equipment, are between $4 and $5 million from the federal government and between $2 and $3 million of local state monies. As I indicated earlier, exactly what happens to research and development centers on university campuses is not perfectly sure, but no matter what happens, we have a large, functional, very useful building, a very desirable building in which to carry out research development activities by a large proportion of the staff of the School of Education.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to conclude by saying that the University of Wisconsin and the School of Education have been very, very good to me. So has education more generally. As I indicated earlier, I have spent all of my life in teaching or in preparing to teach, going to college. And I wouldn't change my life retrospectively, which is primarily that of a teacher, as much as a researcher or administrator, in any way. Education has been very good to me. I am still achieving some very important life goals, many I have achieved, and I've enjoyed every bit of it all of the way. I am especially grateful that some years ago, 1968, I was awarded a special chaired professorship by the Board of Regents. That chaired professorship has enabled me to do many things which I have enjoyed doing and which I hope have contributed to not only the maintenance of this school of education as one of the outstanding ones in the country, but also has made some contribution to the university. And I suspect what I'm most appreciative of all is that I, as a kid, finished high school when I was 15. I came from a second-generation family in southern Indiana, born and raised on a farm, and I am sure that had it not been for good public school education, including at universities such as this, I would never have been able to achieve many of my important life goals. And I think part of the reason that today I still work 60 to 80 hours a week, 45 to 50 weeks out of the year, is because I think public education can still do it for the poor kids of today as I was then. And I do believe that this Research and Development Center, as well as the School of Education more broadly, does need a continuing commitment towards that kind of social welfare, the improvement of quality of life in America through improved educational practices. That is what the R&D Center has attempted to do. That's what I am attempting to do in my activities throughout the remainder of my career.